Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
This week's episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by our good friends at DollarShaveClub.com. Dollar Shave Club is the smarter choice. You get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. It's an awesome life hack, a no-brainer choice. You no longer have to shelp to the store to get a cheap disposable razor that's going to scratch up your face, scratch up your head, scratch up your ball sack, scratch up your butthole. Even ladies, if you're doing it, it'll scratch up your vagina. I don't have a vagina, but I imagine that if you scratched it all up with a cheap razor, it would hurt. That's why I have my wife use the razors from DollarShaveClub.com whenever she shaves her legs, pits, whatever she's got to shave. I don't even know what women shave. They shave everything, arms, whatever. DollarShaveClub.com is the best way to do it because you can use an executive razor with their Dr. Carver shave butter. The blade just gently glides, giving me such a smooth shave no matter where I'm using it on my body. It doesn't have to just be your face. You too can make a smarter choice by joining DollarShaveClub.com. But hey, chaps, how do we do that? For a limited time, new members get their first month of the executive razor with the tube of Dr. Carver's shave butter for only $5 with free shipping. That's right, folks, free shipping. After that, razor just a few bucks a month. In your first month's box, you'll get an awesome, weighty handle, not some cheap bullshit, a full cassette of four cartridges, which is going to last you much longer than a month, and a tube of their shave butter, which feels like butter. Appropriately named, my friends. After your first month, the replacement cartridges ship automatically at the regular price. There's no hidden fees, no commitments. Cancel anytime you want. Join DollarShaveClub.com/chaps. DollarShaveClub.com/chaps. That's DollarShaveClub.com/chaps. Charlie, Hotel, Alpha, Papa, Sierra, Chaps. Zero Block 30 time. Things are happening in the office. They have Royals legend Pete. Nope.
George Brett.
George Brett. Yeah, George Brett in the office. So you might hear a little background noise, but that's okay. This is the Barstool difference, I guess. Like, you're going to hear some different shit. Connor, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing very well, Chapsy. Seems like you were just here, but now you're not, so I miss you. But how's everything going down in Texas?
It's going well, man. It was a good week for us. Having Kyle Carpenter on the podcast was an all-time high, like, for me.
Yeah.
That was a big-time bucket list interview. Just talking to him and seeing how incredibly humble he is was awesome. I love that interview. It was a great one.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about guys you could really just go have a beer with, he embodied that. It was us just kind of hanging out, talking, and it was almost really as if the three of us were just sitting on a couple bar stools, throwing a few beers back. He was great. He was very candid. He was very thoughtful and thorough in his answers, and I think it was great for our listeners to hear something like that, because obviously you can go, you can read stories about him, you can watch the YouTube of him being presented with his medal, but you're not going to get those behind the scenes, so to speak, stories unless you have the opportunity to speak to him one-on-one. So I'm very grateful that he shared so much time with us, and it really was a fantastic interview.
Yeah, the difference between what you see like from CNN or Fox or wherever you get your news from and what you see in an interview like that is that you see that they're just normal dudes. Like, we portray as like a media and as a society guys like Kyle, their stories, just for that's all they are as a person, is just a straight up fucking hero. When in reality, that's probably the smallest portion of their character is who mm-hmm. they are as a person. Yeah. Like, he doesn't walk around every day as a hero. He walks around as Kyle, the dude who loves the University of South Carolina, loves the Marine Corps, loves his buddies, probably loves slugging beers, and is just a great all-around person. Like,
yeah.
That's who he is. He just happened to be in a position where he took the most heroic steps that a human being could take.
And what's always wild to me is then you take someone like that who's awarded such a high recognition, and then they're just automatically expected to be this person who's great at giving interviews, great at public speaking, great at being a public figure, great at being a spokesman. And it's like, it's really a crapshoot that you're going to get someone who has those personality traits, because when you consider some of the groups he's speaking to, and I mean, he's been on national TV, like, you can't just pick someone off the street and assume they're going to be comfortable in those situations.
And I don't think he was at first, and he's like grown into that.
Yeah.
Like, and I read John Bassalone's biography and Chesty Puller's as well, and they were both really uncomfortable with the media side. And I think people don't realize that whenever they were such superstars, and they really were superstars in World War II, like,
oh, yeah,
before World War II even kicked off, they were superstars. And they came back and they had to sell war bonds and do things like that. But it was luck of the draw. Like, Bassalone happened to be handsome. Chesty Puller happened to have this just, like, you know, John Wayne.
All right, yeah,
so when you picture John Wayne, like, that's a dude who is, you know, he's a Western cowboy.
Yep.
When you see John Wayne, that's the look of a Chesty Puller. And Kyle doesn't have that. Like, that's not what we think of when you see Kyle Carpenter. When you see him walk down the street, he doesn't look like a grizzly old veteran like Clint Eastwood. And what was the movie that Clint Eastwood was in where he's like the old veteran that has...
Oh, yeah, that's a great one. Gran Torino.
Gran Torino, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Kyle doesn't look like that.
No, Kyle looks like a college student.
But he's a fucking hero.
Yeah.
And it just happens to be a small portion of his life.
Yeah.
So it was great. It was great to have him on. So a little bit of news this week. There's a big stink last week about President Trump saying... Congrats to a guy who had a Purple Heart. And I had a little bit of a rant about Twitter.
Yeah, I hope everyone, if you haven't, go back and look at Zero Block 30's Twitter feed. Chaps posted a video, but what did you have to say about that?
I think that this is a prime example of why the news media as a whole is viewed as just people screaming into a microphone for no reason.
Yep.
I feel like no matter what side of the aisle on, you're going to have your opinion on Trump. And anybody who's listened to this show for any number of weeks knows exactly what my feelings are about President Trump. Not a huge fan. That being said, if we continue the process down the road of where we say that every single thing that he does is horrific, the things that are actually horrific, if you believe they're horrific, don't appear to be horrific. It's majoring in minor issues. It's constantly making your last ditch stand in the wrong ditch. In order to make your last ditch stand appropriate, you have to pick it at the right time.
Yeah.
And people aren't doing that. That story did not deserve to be on the front of Fox News, CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all at the same time. It wasn't that big of a deal.
No, you made such a great point. It's really semantics. It's like he said congratulations. That was just one way of expressing his gratitude. If you're like, oh, you congratulate someone who did this, that, or you're not supposed to say congratulations to someone who was injured in battle. It's like, come on, man. Like, go ahead.
Semantics like that are really prevalent in a military community, too. Like,
yeah,
you hear it all the time. Like, and I still mess up when I say it. Like, I'll be like, oh, he was awarded the Medal of Honor. No, he's a Medal of Honor recipient. Like, there
right.
are certain little parts of speech that even if you spend years around the military, you're still going to mess up. Is saying congratulations to a Purple Heart recipient the most appropriate thing in the world? Probably not. Probably saying thank you for your service, I appreciate your sacrifice, is the most poignant way of saying it. It's the most appropriate way of saying it. But I'm not at the position, and I don't think anybody should be in the position where you say, this is outrageous, because it's not outrageous. It was a simple mistake.
Yeah, and I mean,
sentiment matters.
That's what I was going to say. His sentiment was... he wanted to express his gratitude for the service and making that sacrifice that he was injured. And, you know, that's all that matters.
I think this is like 2 or 3 weeks in a row where we've talked about current events where I've been put in the position where I feel like I had to defend the president. And if the left media keeps doing that, I'm going to be really upset because I don't want to defend him at a whole lot of stuff. But, like, if you put it out there and I feel like it's wrong, like Riggs and I talked about it a couple weeks ago. It's like righty-tighty, lefty-loosey. On both sides, you're just going so crazy. Like, the right thinks that they have to say that everything that Trump does is great, and the left feels like they have to say that everything that he does is wrong. There can be common sense somewhere in the middle, and you can find those spots where you really believe that this is the right thing to do or this is the wrong thing to do and speak on that, not just because in parentheses in his name it's R or D.
Yeah, that's I think, and that's where people get hung up. They just feel And, you know, I was probably guilty of this when I was younger. I just always approached topics from a conservative viewpoint. So I was like, well, this is the stance I'm taking because this is the stance I'm supposed to take as a conservative. Whereas, thank God, as I've gotten older and I've gained a little more life experience and I've gained a little more perspective, I'm able to take things individually and examine them for what they are and make my standpoint based on what the situation is, not because I associate myself as a conservative or a liberal or someone down the middle. And I think, obviously, that's the problem that we're having right now, is that people aren't doing that.
And I would consider myself a Democrat, for sure. Like, if I went down the tenets of what it means to be a Democrat, right, what the Democratic Party stands for, probably a large majority, 70-80%, somewhere in there, I would probably fall on the Democratic side. But if you do 100%, if you're a 100% person, like, use your brain.
Yeah.
Use your brain.
Then you sound just like a ridiculous talking head, like a Tommy Lahren, where you're just, all right, you're just screaming. And guess what? You're going to get support from people. People are going to back you up. But that, just because you get support, and I think that's where we run into an issue. When you make a point, just because you get support doesn't mean you're right. That just means there's more people who are wrong, just like you. Does that make sense?
No, it makes complete sense.
Yeah, and that's the problem, especially in Twitter and social media. You really, a lot of times, you associate with people, like-minded individuals. So we've heard this term so much now, the echo chamber. You're just going to be feeling like, oh, I'm just always making great points, and I'm always right. When in
I don't even think it's about, like, echo chamber. I think it's everybody likes the fucking dunk. Like, everybody wants to just dunk on somebody.
Yeah, well, I mean, dunking on someone's a great feeling.
It is. It is. I'm a big Twitter guy. I fucking love Twitter. I love Instagram. I love all that shit. But that can't be all that politics is about, especially, like, your social media presence. If you're going to get your news from there, you can't just look for somebody on the opposite side to quote tweet them, to just put them in a body bag so you get a million GIFs of people getting dunked on. Like, it does it feel good? Sure. But is it helpful? Like, is it really enriching in a conversation? Absolutely not. And that's not the point for some people. Some people just like to fucking dunk. Anyways, hit that fucking doggy bag music, Charlie.
From a gentleman who has to
track. Let's explain doggy bag. For those new listeners haven't been around since we came on, I was a dog trainer for 10 years in the Marine Corps. I was the chief instructor at the military working dog school at Lackland. And so that's why we have our listeners tweet in or DM us on either my account, Connor's account, or the Zero Blog 30 account, which you should follow at Zero Blog and then 30, the number on Twitter and Instagram. All right, let's go, Connor.
Right. So this gentleman has to travel a lot, brings his dog, and his dog constantly throws up in the car. How the hell do you fix your dog throwing up in the car when you have to travel?
All right, and see, this is the thing with questions like this. It involves a lot of nuance, and I know a lot of people don't like nuance, whether in politics, military, or dog training.
No, they just want the answer. They're just like, chaps, what do I do? What do I go buy to make my dog stop puking?
Right, so my first question to this dude or a woman, whoever, would be, how often do you feed the dog right before you're doing this? So if you know the dog has motion sickness, because that's what it is, like they do. A lot of dogs have motion sickness, one, because they don't ride in the car that often, mm-hmm. or two, because their owner feeds them and gives them water too quickly before they go in.
Is that like people who would get like car sick or sick it's on exactly, a boat? It's the same thing?
Yeah, because they're just not used to it. Dogs have a lot of sensory in their pads. So for a personal story, like whenever I lived in Okinawa, my first military working dog, Orlando, he was a beast, badass. He would hit the wrap so hard, like the wrap is the thing that they would attack. He would hit it so hard that at the age of 8, he lost all of his teeth. Like he knocked his own teeth out because he would bite so hard.
Wow.
So, and he would still do it with no teeth. Well, he had 4 titanium inserts that were red, white, and blue. They were pretty badass. So when he'd snarl at you, you'd see like red, white, and blue. Like,
that's sick.
Fangs. He was pretty badass. But he was awesome all the time, except for when we would have to go do searches on boats. When, like, the Mews would come in from, like, Thailand or Korea or wherever, we would do drug sweeps on the boat. As soon as his dumbass feet hit the pavement on top of, like, an aircraft carrier or the USS Essex, as soon as it would hit, he would start looking sick. And if he walked around for, like, 5 minutes on the boat, he would puke. Every single time, just because it was a feeling that he wasn't used to. And dogs can do that too. Like, dogs get motion sickness. So sometimes there's not anything you could do.
What are some signs of a dog that it's about to get sick. So if I'm driving in the car with my dog and I look back in the rear view and it's like, oh, he's making this face or doing this, like maybe I should pull over.
Usually dogs will get really quiet. They'll hunker down, you know, like a basically fight or flight situation. They'll tuck their tail between their legs, get as low as they possibly can. Just like when you're about to throw up and you have, you know, like if you're about to puke, you've been drinking too much, you'll start getting a little bit more saliva in your mouth, like mm-hmm. too much spit.
Yep.
Dogs will start drooling a little bit more. Same type of situation.
Gotcha. Fun fact, I haven't thrown up from consuming alcohol since March 27th, 2006. I got a good streak going. That's a true fact.
But yeah, so, no, I think I'm past that point in my life, too. I don't throw up either.
No, it's, you know, just go sleep it off. But
it's either the sign of somebody with a good stomach or just being an alcoholic. Could be both.
I think it's a little bit of both for me. Just genetically being an Irishman, I have that tough stomach and then a lot of practice. But so is that really all it is? It's just paying attention to what they feed?
Yeah, that's one thing that you're just, I mean, it could not, it might not ever be fixed. It could be just be who the dog is.
Okay. All right, and then this one is actually from me. And I've thought this many times before, and I'm very thankful that I've run into you in my life because I think I can maybe get somewhat of an answer now. So working and walking the streets of New York City, obviously you see homeless people all the time, and that is very sad. What's even sadder, though, is when you see a homeless person with a dog. Where they got that dog, if that dog was homeless to begin with, or if it was their dog before they became homeless, doesn't matter. My question to you is, now, and understanding and appreciation the bond that people have with their dogs, is that fair to a dog to leave the dog homeless with you? Or should you take that dog to a shelter where the dog can have a place to sleep and get food on a regular basis? What do you think is the move?
I mean, usually the dog's going to die if it goes to a shelter. I mean,
okay.
Just statistically across the country, most kennels aren't no-kill. And I would say that the dog doesn't give a shit. I mean, my dog, Saika, would run up underneath my ball sack, and he was looking for bombs every day. Like, yeah. So I feel like it's a little more safe to be a homeless guy dog, like when you're chilling in Manhattan, than it would be to be looking for bombs in Fallujah as like a daily activity. So I think that if that gives the homeless person, who by and large they usually have some mental issues going on, if it gives you a sense of comfort and things like that, I don't think the dog cares. Like, the dog doesn't know he's homeless.
That's what,
like,
I was going to ask. He has no idea, right?
Yeah, he just wants to be a companion. And I'm sure that all those dogs that are with the homeless people love their homeless people. Like, and they want to hang out with them. And if you ask them, you're like, hey, puppy, you want to come with me in my Bentley? Or you want to roll out with your homeless dude? He'll be like, I like the way my homeless dude smells, man. I'm going to chill here.
Yeah, I don't know. It always seems like the dog looks sad. And I feel bad for the dog. I just feel like
they're probably sad because they don't move around a lot. I mean, that's the shitty part when you know that they're just like hanging out on a corner all day. Like, that does kind of suck. But I mean, I think Gus would like it. I think my dog Gus would be a great homeless person dog.
And
like, you would love
it. What type of dog is Gus, and why would Gus be great at being homeless?
He's just lazy as fuck, and he's a mastiff ridgeback mix, and he just would prefer not to move all day. His favorite activity is going and putting his back against the fence and staring directly into the sun for hours. Like, it's his no shit favorite thing to do. And he does it every morning. I feed him at 8 o'clock every single morning. He goes, puts his back against the fence and stares into the sun for hours.
Okay. That's great.
And Otto just runs around in like a circle and like, what are you doing, Gus? And Gus is like, the sun's just so beautiful. Maybe Gus is a scientist. Maybe he's like an astronomer.
Okay. Good to know about Gus. And I just thought of one more question. We're coming up on the month of May, and then, you know, obviously summer coming right after that. And you obviously see a lot of people with pools. Is there a way to get your dog comfortable with swimming? Are certain breeds more comfortable being in water? Is there something you could do besides just throwing your dog in and having him or her just have those survival instincts kick in and start paddling to get them comfortable with being around the water?
Throwing your dog in the water is one of the worst ways to get them used to water. Just like you. Like, if you were a toddler who's just thrown straight the fuck into the water, you're not going to like it.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, hey, I might die in this situation.
That's kind of scary.
Not going to be good. I'm going to avoid it. Mm-hmm. So your best thing to do is, we talked about it a little bit on Podfathers, which you should download, subscribe, and review. There's a a theory called successive approximation. It's a training theory where you have baby steps. So you start them off with something small. Like in order to get a dog to fetch, the very first thing that you could do with fetch in successive approximation is get them to look at the ball in your hand. Because in order for them to want to fetch it, they have to know what they're going to get. The second step in a successive approximation is them to follow the ball after you throw it. So it's kind of like that with getting them into the pool. If you can get them up to the edge of the pool or the lake or the river or wherever you're at and just get them to get their feet wet. And as soon as they get their feet wet, good boy. Yay. You did so awesome. Make it a happy little game. And so every time they get a little bit further into the water, yay. And if they want to back up, that's fine. You don't have to keep them there. Let them take their little step, back up, regain their confidence, and come back in.
Can dogs, forgive this question, like you use the analogy of a toddler. If I threw a toddler in a pool, it would flail around, but eventually it would probably drown. Would, if I just threw a dog in the pool, do they have better survival instincts? Or if I just threw a dog, would it eventually just sink?
A pool might be a little bit different because there's going to be an edge. If there is like a natural beach type situation, like you have like in a lake or whatever, and you throw them in the middle of the lake, the dog usually can find their way out and be fine. The dog is going to be able to swim naturally. It's just a natural instinct of them to be able to swim. Unless you're an asshole and you get your dog's tail cut off. Like if you do that, they don't have their natural rudder and they just spin around in circles until they get used to it.
Oh, interesting.
A dog's tail is kind of like the bow of a boat or the rudder of a boat where it kind of guides where they're going to go.
Cool. All right. And are there...
And I know that from experience because Saika, my working dog, got his tail cut off like 3 weeks before he went to Iraq because he spins around in his kennel like a crazy ass.
Uh-huh.
And like I walked into his kennel one day. It was a steam from Hostel. Like there's fucking blood everywhere. And Psycho just like, he looked at me like Will Arnett in Arrested Development and was like, I made a huge mistake. his tail was just bloody as shit. So he had to cut it off, which is basically like cutting off a piece of their spine. And then we ended up being in a place in Iraq called Karma. In Saika, there's lakes and ponds and stuff like that all over Okinawa. And he used to love to play fetch in the water.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know the thing about the rudder at the time. And so we were on this little bridge and at Baharia, Lake Baharia is where we were at. And I throw a ball into the water. And Saika jumps into the water to go get the ball like he has done 1,000 times. But this time was the first time he didn't have a tail. And so he's just like spinning in a circle in the middle of the lake. And I had to like drop all my gear and jump in the lake to get him out. And it was a shitty lake because that's where Uday Hussein was rumored to like kill soccer team players and dump their bodies into the lake.
That is unfortunate. So would you recommend getting a life preserver for a dog who is learning how to swim?
Yeah, if you're going to be like boating with your dog or something like that until they know like what to do, because you never know. Dogs are dumb as shit. They might just jump off the boat while you're going fast and they don't know what to do.
Yeah, because I would just
They get winded. I mean, same thing. They get winded from swimming too long.
Yeah. No, I would just assume a dog would just know how to swim. I just feel like they would have a better instinct for that than humans would. So that is interesting to hear. So, I think those are great answers, and I think that about does it for Doggy Bag this week.
All right. Well, with that being said, we're going to move on to our next portion of our interview with, well, to our interview with Representative Rooney from the 17th District of Florida. And that interview is going to be brought to you by the boys at ZBT. That's right, us. Make sure you're going to help us out, help our store out, help us keep this podcast free, all of our content at Barstool Sports free by going to barstoolsports.com, go to the store, get ZBT gear. ZBT gear is different than almost every single thing else in the Barstool store because a portion of what we sell is going to go to Canines for Warriors, which is a charity in Jacksonville, Florida. And eventually, once we sell enough, we as a podcast group, as a crew, as an online VFW type situation, we are going to be able to name a dog that a wounded warrior is going to have as their service dog. And it is going to be fucking awesome. So go to Zero Blog 30 store. We have a shirt for everybody. We're going to have a Coast Guard store up. Shout out to the Coast Guard. You guys always bitching that you never get love. Here's a little bit of love. Connor's going to give you some love later as well. So go to the Zero Blog 30 section. Get your Marine, Army, Navy, and Air Force shirts. Zero Blog 30 store in the Barstool store. We also got socks. We got other shit coming too. So go there. Well, now on Zero Blog 30, I have the privilege of introducing Congressman Tom Rooney of the 17th District in Florida. I'm a Florida guy, so it's nice to have a congressman on from my home state. He went to the University of Florida, originally went to the University of Syracuse, where he got his bachelor's degree, on to the University of Florida. Even though I was a Florida State guy growing up, he went there, get his ROK, and then went to Miami. So he went to pretty much two of my hate schools, but that's all right. He then joined the Army, where he was in the JAG Corps, and now he is a congressman, and I'm sure that there is a bunch of stuff in between. Anyways, Congressman Rooney, welcome to Zero Block 30, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that bio. And, you know, one time when I was a legal assistance attorney for the 1st Cavalry Division down at Fort Hood, I had a kid, an enlisted kid, come in, and he had a very serious issue going on. He just stared at my wall for a few minutes and wasn't answering my questions. And I thought that he, you know, was broken up or something, but he just asked me how I could have Florida and Miami on the wall. On my wall at the same time. So
it is pretty weird.
I've been trying to answer that for a while.
That is a pretty weird move, but I feel like it's different when it's graduate school. I feel like if you went and you got your BA from Florida and then going on to Miami, it'd be a little bit different. But since they're both graduate degrees, it might make it a little bit better.
Well, the truth isn't all that sexy. I applied to law school at the University of Florida too and did not get in, so I went to Miami.
Well, there you go. So who do you root for whenever you're having sports? Is it Syracuse? You go with your BA?
No, I only went to Syracuse for a year and then transferred to a little college outside of Pittsburgh called Washington and Jefferson for football reasons. But I should have stayed at Syracuse and just been a student. But between Miami and Florida, one of my buddies played for Florida when I was there. So I went to all the games and really got into it. I'm not going to deny, when the Hurricanes were playing, growing up in South Florida in the 80s, it was kind of hard to avoid the Hurricanes. So, you know, depending on who they play, especially Florida State, I root for Miami.
Oh, I don't blame you. I mean, I still love watching those old hate videos where the Miami guys are in the camouflage going up against Penn State and Notre Dame. Those are all-time great sports moments. Yeah.
Good 30 for 30.
So. Oh, absolutely. Some of the best ones.
So now you spend your time as a congressman after your time in the Army was over. And a lot of our listeners, we have a pretty big, like, 18 to 34 demographic. A lot of people don't really know what it entails whenever you are a member of the committees that you are. So can you walk us through how you get selected to the committee, like the Armed Service Committee, for example? How did that come about?
Well, when you first get elected, a lot of this has to do with the speaker, or in the case in my situation, we were in the minority in 08, so the minority leader, who at that time was John Boehner. And a lot of it has to do with what's called a steering committee, which is just a group of different people from different classes or different areas of the country or different committee chairs. But the speaker or the minority leader has a lot of pull. And so, you know, if you get elected to Congress and you say, hey, you know, I was in the Army and I taught at West Point, I'd really like to be on the Armed Services Committee, plus we're at war. You know, it's a lot of it has to do with whether or not that guy or Speaker Pelosi, when she was Speaker, wants you on a certain committee. If you don't sort of play nice, I mean, you could find yourself on a committee that you don't have any interest in, and that you don't know really helps your district. But what I try to do is have a committee that I know helps my district, and then a committee that I'm just interested in personally. And so that's how I got on Armed Services, but I was also on agriculture because my district is by and large orange juice and beef cattle. If you look at it, if you Google Florida 17th District, you can see why. We're like the largest orange juice producing district in the country. So I have to represent my constituents up here. As Tip O'Neill once said, all politics is local. So just being on the Armed Services Committee, in my district, there aren't any military bases, so it doesn't really matter much to them except, you know, as Americans. I have a lot of veterans there, you know, being on Armed Services was something that I thought that I could just lend some intelligence to. And then that's evolved over the years. There's what's called A committees, like appropriations and ways and means. Those are the more powerful committees. As you get more seniority, you try to get on those committees, and I'm on appropriations, and I'm on agriculture appropriations. So we spend the money that the Ways and Means Committee taxes when they bring the money in. We have the chance to sort of dole it out. And a lot of what I do is look to make sure that Florida's orange juice industry is protected, especially from disease. And then I sit on the Intelligence Committee, which is not a political committee, and it's not one that I can really ever talk about, but it's just something I'm extremely interested in. And I'm the chairman of the subcommittee on the NSA. And so, you know, I hear all of our country's secrets, and that sort of stems from my military background.
Now, that's the one I kind of wanted to talk to you. When you first signed on and you got that position, was there anything that just really, like, blew your mind? Did you have to kind of take a deep breath? Was it almost like the moment where you hear presidents talk about the moment that they sit behind the Oval Office, behind the desk in the Oval Office? Once you got all this information, were you just kind of overwhelmed at first, or was it something that you felt like you were prepared for?
I don't think that anybody can be prepared for it, but it was good to know that what your country is doing, what you hope your country is doing, we're doing. And it's not just all sort of like, fiction novel stuff. But by the same token, it can be frustrating because some of the things that people say we're doing, we're not doing. And I can tell you, like, you know, for a lot of the people out there that, you know, may believe that we're listening to all your phone calls and reading all your emails, we're not. I know that that sounds sexy to scare people like that, and it helps raise money, but, I mean, you know, it's just not an accurate statement. So there are frustrations with stuff like that, but there's also stuff when we get to travel abroad and meet with our assets in foreign countries and hear about what they're doing and what kind of protections they're giving to this country. You're extremely proud, but you're also, you know, you feel good about the United States of America, that we're doing the kind of stuff that you'd hope that we'd be doing. But then there's also things like, you know, the day after Benghazi, we got to watch the whole thing on our you know, we had cameras all over the compound and the annex. And so we saw a lot of what you would have seen in that movie, 13 Hours. We saw it, you know, in near real time. The same goes for when we got bin Laden in Abbottabad. A lot of that was filmed on SEALs Kevlar. So it was that's the kind of stuff that a lot of people don't get to watch for whatever security reason. There might be something that we're doing in those situations, or some kind of tool that we're using, what we call in the intelligence community sources and methods, the way that we do stuff, we can't share, because then the bad guys know how to prepare the next time this happens. If they've seen it on TV, then they know how to maybe try to avoid making the same mistake. So we get
right. You don't want to give away SEAL Team 6's tactics, because then you can basically be like a football coach and have the game taken.
Correct. Absolutely.
Get a defense.
So, Congressman, you mentioned Benghazi. You wrote a bill that was ultimately defeated, and then you came out and blamed President Obama for what happened at Benghazi. Do you ever have that feeling, like the, you know, the almost like I told you so feeling, that, you know, hey, if you just listened to what I had to say in my bill, maybe things would have gone a little differently?
Well, I'm not looking to have an I told you so moment at the expense of the commander in chief, even though he's in a different party than me. That wasn't the aim there. The aim was that, you know, we had a situation where I felt like, with all the evidence that I saw, that there was a decision made that we were not going to put more boots on the ground in another Middle Eastern country under Obama's watch. This was especially evident during what was, you guys remember, the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. that we were getting out of Afghanistan, we were getting out of Iraq, that the White House was not going to put soldiers into a new country. And so, therefore, the situation in Benghazi happened. It took a long time to happen. And the one question that I never got answered was, even though we got a lot of people out of there successfully, we lost people, but we got a lot of people out there successfully, I'm very confident that had we not extracted those people when we did, with I think the four people that came from another part of the country, that all those people would be dead. And so my question that I never got answered is, how did you all know it was going to, when it was going to end? And by that I mean, when we were told time and time again that there wasn't enough time to get help to that compound or to the airport in Benghazi, therefore we weren't sending anybody, I always ask, well, how did you know it wasn't going to go on for 6 more hours or however long it was going to take to get somebody there? They couldn't answer that question. And the answer for me is the obvious, I think, is that they were never going to be sent. And so thank God the people got out that got out. But, you know, I really think that if people were sent immediately as soon as we knew that the ambassador was killed, that those other guys might have lived as well.
And I think what you said, what you're saying about that situation where you need to know how you're going to get out, goes into Mattis's doctrine, Secretary Mattis's doctrine about having a complete war plan before you start a war.
Right.
With President Trump's 100 days coming up, there's a lot of news reports that are saying that Mattis is in a lot more control of the Pentagon than any Secretary of Defense has been in recent years. Do you find that to be true?
Well, I think that you got the best guy for the job for sure. And, you know, I know people that are working over there, and so I'm extremely comfortable with him. I would like to see them staff up a little faster, and I know that they're doing the best that they can, but, you know, he does need a network beneath him that's going to help him do his job better, especially if something should happen unforeseen, whether it be North Korea or wherever. He's going to need a bigger team than he has now. But as far as him being at the top, there's no better secretary, I think.
And speaking, you know, further to that point about Trump's first 100 days and his first 100 days, as well as all his cabinet and staff, you know, we wrestle every day with, you know, what's real, what's fake news. What's the sentiment? What's the pulse on the Hill from your perspective on how he's doing so far, as well as all of his subordinates?
I think that are we talking Trump or Mattis? I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that.
Well, President Trump.
President Trump, but also everybody underneath him.
Just the executive branch as a whole.
Yeah.
Right. I think that, you know, certainly there's been a lot of things that we've done together. We had to sort of set the table for him to be able to do some executive orders that, you know, didn't get too much press coverage. And I think that those have certainly helped. I mean, it, you know, just a really sort of obscure example in my district, you know, we have a lot of agriculture, as I told you guys before. And we had this executive order that dealt with waters of the USA where any little, there's a buzzer going off right now about voting. So I apologize for that. But any little cow pond could be potentially considered navigable waters, and it was just killing my farmers. So, you know, things like repealing that or revoking that by the president, those are little things that you'll never hear about on TV, and he's done a lot of that kind of stuff. The people that he's put in place for national security, we talked about Mattis, General Kelly, obviously Mike Pompeo at CIA. You know, the list goes on at the NSC. It's just been great. I mean, for those of us that have served in the military and dealt with, you know, military issues for the whole time I've been in Congress, I mean, those guys are really the top of the top. And then getting a Supreme Court justice installed in the first 100 days, for a lot of people, their whole rationale for voting for Trump, regardless of everything that they might have a problem of him, was that he was going to put a conservative on the court in the sort of guise of Antonin Scalia. So that was a huge deal. You know, some people have said if he does nothing else and just did that, it's a success. So, you know, you got a young guy on the court that could be there for 30 plus more years. So I'm very happy, and I was not a huge Trump supporter. I was a Marco Rubio guy. I was his Florida chairman. That did him a lot of good. But, it is what it is, and he's our president. And I think that, especially on the national security side, I think that we're in a really good spot.
Is your association with agriculture one of the big reasons why you've paid probably more attention to what's going on in the South Sudan than your colleagues in Congress?
That's part of it. I mean, one of the things, I'm also on a subcommittee on appropriations that deals with state and foreign ops funding. So things like, you know, our embassies and the people that are in these faraway lands that are trying to help avoid us going to war and getting us into wars in the first place. If we have good diplomacy, then we don't have to have kinetic activity. That's, you know, the wish. But actually, it's sort of an interesting story. You know, part of what we do is determine whether or not we can help with agriculture in Africa to help them feed themselves. South Sudan, certainly not in the Saharan region. They're in what's called the breadbasket of Africa. They can feed themselves. But here you have a country that is experiencing famine right now, and there's no drought. I mean, as absurd as that sounds. They also could be facing genocide if the UN stops funding certain refugee camps that are keeping this minority tribe basically alive. And I've talked with Secretary Nikki Haley about how important those are. Nobody wants to live in those refugee camps. We all get that. But we also don't want to have genocide and famine on our hands in a country that we helped set up just a few years ago. But the impetus of my involvement in South Sudan actually started, I don't know if you guys know this, but I have a famous cousin named Rooney Mara who was very active in raising awareness for South Sudan, and she asked me to try to get involved, and so I did, and now I'm the chairman of the South Sudan caucus, and I was in South Sudan 2 weeks ago, and you know, trying to help as much as I can and do everything that I can. I mean, it's difficult because people in my district don't care about South Sudan, so you sort of ride that line of trying to do the right thing for a country that needs a lot of help versus, you know, how much is it taking away from my time doing the things that are important for my district.
Yeah, and in that regard, you know, believe me, I think famine in Africa is an issue that needs to be addressed and needs the attention that you're giving it. But is it something that we can eradicate, or are we just fighting a losing battle ultimately?
Look, your frustration is warranted because the guys that I met over there that are underneath the leaders in some regard aren't any better. And a lot of it's just about power. And it's not about Muslim versus Christianity. This is the Christian side of the Sudan deal that we brokered. This is a tribal deal. And so, and it's just basically bad blood between two guys that can't get over it. And so, I don't know the answer. I can just tell you that the model in Rwanda and the model in other places in Africa who are experiencing similar things in the last couple decades could be instructive as to how we get out of this situation in South Sudan. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, when I met with the president there and he thought that he was going to have a better relationship with the United States because of Trump, I assured him that Trump is not going to want to invest our U.S. tax dollars in a country that's involved in a civil war. It's not a good bet. And so I think that that sort of surprised him a little bit that I was that blunt. But, you know, he needs to hear that. And if we are going to spend our tax dollars in such a way, that they got to know that we're not going to do it if they can't stop fighting and people not coming out of their homes because they're worried about getting killed.
Yeah, right. No, I think it's necessary to be that blunt, like you said, because I'd imagine in years past, we've just paid these people lip service to say that we're going to help. But, you know, if we're not going to help them and for good reason, then there's no reason to lie to them.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times people go over to places like, although nobody's going to South Sudan, I assure you that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times people go over there on a diplomatic trip and kind of freeze up and don't say what they need to say. But, I mean, I didn't have any problem talking frank to this guy. So,
and that's probably yourself and a lot of other congressmen who are former JAG officers. Did you get a lot of experience on talking to those people from doing all the work with the tribal leaders that you did in Iraq and Afghanistan as far as nation building goes?
I never deployed, so I was never called up to deploy. When I was teaching at West Point, I think at that time when the war started, we were non-deployable. I think that they did become deployable after I left. But I do think that some of the things that I learned about in the JAG Corps, and also just being in this job for five terms, you sort of get to a point where it's just like, look, this is the facts, and the facts are that we want you to succeed, because if you succeed, then people stop dying. But we're willing to help you succeed. But if you can't figure out your own domestic quarrels, then we can't be part of it anymore. And so, you know, I wasn't yelling at him. I wasn't threatening him with anything. I was just telling him the truth. And I think that he understood it. But, you know, President Kiir's, he is unfortunately fixated on the past and who basically started the fight and, you know, stuff that you don't really want to hear when you're trying to help them get out of their problems.
Well, from a heavy point, we're going to move on to a lighter point. We have a segment that we like to call Hurry Up and Wait. And you, as a former soldier, you've spent a lot of time doing Hurry Up and Wait, where you talked with your troops or with your coworkers about just some of the dumbest questions. Do you want to play the game?
Oh, geez. Okay. Sure.
Okay. So we asked Medal of Honor recipient Kyle Carpenter this question last week, and we'll ask you the same one. Do you think you could paint the kitchen of your house faster with your face or with your knees?
Face. I'm fat.
More surface area. That makes a lot of sense, Congressman.
All right. Second question. Would you rather have pizza cutters as your hands or be a Segway from the waist down?
Segway from the waist down.
Why?
I get to go where I want to go faster, I think. I don't know what you do with pizza cutters for hands, other than it would look cool.
You eat a lot of pizza.
Know. Yeah, you could cut pizza.
Heck of a party trick.
Need to get fatter.
So, Congressman, and just keeping with serious, you mentioned your time at West Point. I actually graduated from West Point in 2006, and I was...
He was going to get that in there.
Well, I had to. It was relevant. Chaps hates that I remind our listeners of that.
Every week.
I just missed you. I left there in 2002, so I think right. You came in the year that I left.
Yes, I did. But was there anything that stuck out for you at your time while you were there at West Point that was especially memorable, or anything that you learned, because there were some tremendous individuals in the law department that you kept with you and help you to this day?
I think that it's just that, you know, how proud I was is sort of like being on the Intelligence Committee and learning what I learned of just not having gone to West Point and being a captain there and having those cadets salute you as you go, you know, to your classrooms outside and, you know, just being part of the long gray line in my own way. I wasn't part of the long gray line, but being able to witness it up close. Just things like, you know, when I first was there and you had, you know, one of the parades, there was still a couple dudes that were from the First World War that were brought back and things like that. And my son was actually born, my son Sean was born at West Point. So I'll always have a connection to that school. But I just felt so honored to be part of it, not having gone to school there, that I got to, you know, kind of pretend like I was in the long gray line for a couple years. But I used to tell them about stories about when I was in college that amazed them about what the things that they couldn't do. So I don't know if it made them feel good or bad about being at that school, but it was funny.
No, I can tell you we appreciated those stories anytime any of our professors would tell us.
Yeah.
Well, Congressman, we want to thank you for your time. We know you're a busy man, and you probably got to smash some votes and do what you're actually elected to instead of talking with us two idiots.
There's
so we appreciate you coming on.
Votes, so it's good timing.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much for coming on again.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish from the Retronauts Podcast, a show about classic video games. we're exploring gaming's history every week. We talk about classic video games and how the medium's past feeds into the industry and culture of today. Want to know more about the people who made Destiny? What's the story behind Mario? And yes, we even explain why they call it Final Fantasy when there's 15 of the things. From arcade classics to the latest retro releases, Retronauts covers it all. Subscribe to us on iTunes or right here on the Podcast One Network. Listening to Retronauts won't help you build your gamer score, but you'll rock at bar trivia.
I don't think many people thought that whenever we started a podcast on military shit that we'd end up talking to a congressman. And I don't think that most people think that Barstool Sports is where you're going to get probably a pretty reasoned take from most congressmen on issues like the Sudan, issues like Benghazi, and Trump's 100 first days. I feel like we've done a pretty good job there.
Hashtag Barstool difference.
It's a weird difference that we're like giving like fair and balanced. And even though I didn't agree with some of the stuff he said, like he's going to be on the show. He can say whatever the fuck he wants to.
Absolutely. Awesome. He was great. That was a really great interview. So we appreciate him coming on.
So you know what is not great? So I retired. I think my retirement went into full-blown effect in 2012. And in 2013, when you do a medical retirement like me, you get a letter from the Commandant of the Marine Corps. The Commandant of the Marine Corps issues you this letter and says, hey, you are hereby permanently retired at this medical rate of whatever, and you can go down to your local deer shop like the ID card place and get military ID that lasts until the day before your 65th birthday, which is pretty awesome. You don't have to go back, because anybody that's been in the military knows getting an ID card is a pain in the fucking dick. It's
the worst.
Terrible. So I saw that paper. My wife's card expired when she was trying to go to a medical appointment like 2 weeks ago, and the MP at the gate took her ID card, so she couldn't get on base because it was expired, which, I mean, that's their job. That's what they're supposed to do. You have to be authorized to get on base, and the ID card shows that you're authorized to get on base. So, no, I'm not hating on them at all. But taking her on there, it's always just such a fucking process, man. And so we get there, and I'm like, sweet, babe, like me and you, I got the letter from the Commandant. It says until we're 65, we don't have to come in here again. So I'm like, I don't have to do this for like 40 years or 30 years. Oh, what about? Yeah, 30 years. And my ID card says that it doesn't expire until 2047, which sounds insane.
That
like,
is.
That sounds like a fake year.
Yeah, seriously. That's a long time from now. I don't even want to think about it.
So mine is 2047. I have to do hers again in 4 years.
That doesn't make any sense.
And I have to go with her whenever she does it. I have to go.
That's unfortunate. I guess that's just them assuming the law of averages and the statistics are that.
You're going to get divorced.
You're going to get divorced, yeah, just because that's so common in the military.
There's no way this dumb redheaded fuck is going to stay married that long. No, she's not going to stay with him that
she
long.
She is going to get wise in under 4 years, and she's going to bolt. So
I'm watching, like, and, you know, like, Marines were ate up about being Marines. So I'm on the base. I'm looking at all these different Air Force people marching by, and the whole time I'm just thinking, you nasty little worm. Like, as soon as the moment that I drive on base, I immediately change back into Staff Sergeant me.
Yeah.
Like, the moment that it happens, and I'm just like, your haircut sucks. Your haircut. Why is your boots fucking undone? Tie your fucking shit. Blouse your fucking shit. Why is your hat all fucked up? Like, I'm just going through the list of everything that I want to say. But then I'm nice when I get out of the car. But the entire time I'm bitching, and my wife's like, just shut up already.
Well,
like,
I mean, that was
been
like,
out for 5 years, dude.
Yeah, I mean, well, that was like, a you know, weeks ago we talked about some of the things we still do. I think there's just some things you just don't turn off. And noticing ate up uniforms and ate up haircuts, that's just something you just never will turn off. I don't care who you are.
No, even when we went to West Point to the game, I was just like looking for uniform corrections to make. Like, it's like a part of who I am. And I can't stop. Like, even when I watch movies and shit, I'm like, look at this fucking sergeant with his fucking haircut. Was it? Like, is he thinking he's on leave? Like, even on leave, you're supposed to get a haircut. I don't care if he's on leave. You don't show up with a beard.
Yeah, that's definitely something I still do as well.
Yeah. All right. Any saving on alibis for you?
Yeah, real quick. Again, hey, Freedom Cruise in Boston, May 20th. Buy your tickets. We're all out of the early bird tickets, but you can still buy tickets available. And don't look at it as you're paying for a higher ticket. Look at it as you're giving more money back to the veterans who need your help. So we appreciate your support, and we are going to have a great time. So I look forward to seeing so many of you out there. And then also, Chaps and I, we're pretty good. We pay attention to the tweets and the DMs and the emails. We see your feedback. We see that we've neglected the Coast Guard, and I apologize for that. Because although, you know, they are not part of the fight internationally, they do protect our national waters, and we do respect them. So I'm going to do everything in my effort and in my power to get Kevin Costner or Ashton Kutcher on here because they played Coast Guard rescue swimmers in a movie once. No, I'm just kidding. But no, we will try to touch on the...
I want to go to that school. That school looks fucking intense, man.
It does. Yeah.
Pretty intense.
No, it does. It
Shout
does.
Out to everybody in the Department of Homeland Security. This is a DOD podcast, but we're trying to get a Department of Homeland Security podcast going on Barstool, too. So the Coast Guard guys will be represented well.